Jobs, sure, but also Iran, some Amazon, and a little Hollywood glamour to wrap things up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, October the 6th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, it is Jobs Day. No, the numbers weren't great, but also there was more than that to the economic week that was. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Neela Richardson is at Redfin. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Sudeep, let me give you first whack at the jobs report. We lost 33,000 jobs last month for the first time in like 7 years. Unemployment rate ticked down. Once you normalize for the hurricane, you worried, not worried, what?
Not worried a whole lot. Okay. The weather can mess with our economic data, whether it's blizzards or hurricanes. And in a month, we are going to see a pretty huge bounce back in jobs that a certain president is going to try to take credit for.
Oh, come on, man. You're going to my second bullet point. But anyway, Neela, I want to talk real quick about wages, because that's one of the things that you talk about every time we have you on a Friday Jobs Day. Up almost 3% year on year. That's not terrible.
You know, I'm going to surprise you, Kai. I don't think we should take that wage number very seriously.
Oh,
you know, the hurricanes affected leisure and hospitality. We saw those jobs were hard hit, and those jobs tend to be low paying. So that might have skewed the averages in wages. This is one jobs report that we might give ourselves permission to skip over.
All right. Consider it skipped in that case. And we only wasted 40 seconds on it. So that's fine. Sudeep, I want to talk about the president of the United States and his failure to grasp the impact of what he says. And and that applies to a lot of things. I'm speaking specifically here about economics. He was talking about wiping out Puerto Rican debt. He was talking about Puerto Rico putting the budget out of whack, neither of which are true or can be true. Is it concerning that he says these things without apparent thought to the ramifications of his words?
It was concerning when we first heard this during the campaign season, and we thought, what would happen if he were to say some of these things if he were actually president? And guess what? He said some of these things when he was actually president, and you saw a sharp response from traders, in this case of Puerto Rico bonds. In the bigger picture, the weird thing here is this was the president of the United States being empathetic with Puerto Ricans talking about bashing Wall Street and getting back at bondholders. It was a lot of loose talk about finance, which he's done a lot. It's just a lot of loose talk. He's an unscripted character. He loves talking like that. Eventually, this is going to catch up with him in an even bigger way. In this case, bondholders finally realized, well, there wasn't actually anything to it. The White House came out, did a lot of cleanup, but sometimes you're going to push a little too far and can't clean it up so easily.
Well, Sunila, let's go there, right? I mean, what happens if this keeps up where he says things that are demonstrably economically not fully informed? Then what?
It raises concern about the debt ceiling, which has to be raised by the end of the year. This cavalier attitude to financial markets and that debt can be simply written off is something that you don't want to hear a president say, because it does have ramifications, as we saw with the Puerto Rican bonds. It's not just being out of being spontaneous. Mm-hmm. It's also being out of step with the rest of your administration. If you have members of your own cabinet saying one thing that is totally contradictory to what the president is saying, there's this real discord, and it's hard to know where to look for the answers. And what financial systems always need is stability and transparency. Right. And that's what's lacking right now.
Okay. Sudeep, ordinarily on a jobs day, I might ask you what Janet Yellen is thinking. I'm not going to do that today because I want to throw another name at you from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. The new vice chair for supervision is a guy by the name of Randall Quarles. He is not a friend of banking regulation and strong supervision, is he?
He is not. He is the first step in swinging the pendulum in the other direction. We saw in the Obama years the Dodd-Frank response, the response to the financial crisis. Randall Quarles is somebody who's going to come in with more of a Bush administration mindset, which is where he worked before. What we have yet to see, though, is what this really means in the big picture for the Trump administration and for Washington policy. We still don't know which Trump we have, the populist one who bashes Wall Street or one who defends big banks and big businesses of all kinds. And so that's what we're hoping to see. We're probably going to see more appointments in the coming weeks, yeah. where we might get a little more, a few more clues to that. But we still don't really know which Trump we have.
But Neela, this bears on Chair Yellen as well, right? Because one of the things upon which her reappointment to the job of chair of the Fed would seem to hang, one of the points on which it would balance, is her stance on regulation. And she has been fairly clear that she wants to lighten up on regulation for smaller banks who have some onerous requirements, but also not step back from bigger banks. And here we now have Quarles sort of sitting right beside her, as it were.
Right. There is a bit more going to show a bit more dissension within the Fed ranks. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing. Look, we all understand that this regulation needed to be tweaked in significant ways. The key here is not to throw out everything. Keep the things that work, like enhanced capital requirements. Loosen the things that may be too onerous, like reporting requirements for community banks. There is room here to negotiate. Optimistically speaking, this could be an opportunity to show bipartisan productivity in how our financial system is regulated.
Neela Richardson at Redfin, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
Kat. Thank you.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, all winning streaks must come to an end. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, a little bit more now about those jobs numbers. Some of the data, as we said, is a one-time hiccup because of the hurricanes. But some of what's going on is also a function of the way the jobs numbers themselves are gathered and crunched every month, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics puts together the monthly jobs report from two separate surveys. And Ben Herzon at Macroeconomic Advisors says they track the job market differently. So someone who had a job, let's say in Florida, but couldn't get to work because of the hurricane could be counted
as employed in the household survey, but not employed in the payroll survey, making an economist's life interesting.
We get the number of jobs in the economy from payroll data. 147,000 employers report how many employees they have, what they're paid, etc. We get the number of people who have or don't have jobs for calculating the unemployment rate from a survey of households. 60,000 of them called every month and asked questions like these.
What was the main reason you were absent from work last week? Do you currently want a job?
And ordinarily, economists trust the payroll data more, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute, because it's a bigger sample and also...
because the payroll survey is a survey of establishments, there are records that they can just transfer over, then that is benchmarked to actual administrative tax records.
The phone survey of households, she says, is fraught with problems.
Somebody not responding to certain questions, people dropping out of the survey.
Except this time around, it probably paints a more accurate picture of the underlying job market. That's because the household survey counted anyone in Florida or Texas who had a job but couldn't get to work in the storms as employed, just as they were the month before and probably will be next month, too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're about 2 weeks and a couple of days since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and still almost 90% of that island is without electricity. Enter now Elon Musk on Twitter, suggesting that the solar and battery storage technologies a couple of his companies happen to offer could be scaled to rebuild the Puerto Rican power grid. To which the governor of Puerto Rico tweeted back, "Let's talk." So given Musk's history of, shall we say, bold pronouncements with, shall we say, delayed results, we asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to check out how realistic it might be to think renewables could power Puerto Rico.
In Puerto Rico's disaster, sustainability advocates see an opportunity.
Puerto Rico can rebuild and reset in a way that nothing else would have allowed them this starting point.
That's sustainability expert John Picard. Puerto Rico's power grid, he thinks, is primed to be rebuilt and reset around renewables.
I would focus on harvesting the sun and the wind and a large focus on Puerto Rico storing its own energy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly possible.
That's Vivek Chandas. He teaches urban studies at Portland State University. Possible, he says, but turning Puerto Rico into a renewable energy-powered paradise would have its challenges. Among them, the sheer scale of the project. About 3.5 million people live in Puerto Rico. And before the storm, they got less than 3% of their energy from solar and wind.
The amount of infrastructure required would lend itself to one of the more massive projects, I think, Puerto Rico would have ever had to address.
There's also the cost. It'd be expensive. And the building codes and the regulations. And maybe the most important challenge is the immediacy of the need. People need power now. Daniel Kirshen is an electrical engineer at the University of Washington.
I think in the short run, we have to rebuild as quickly as possible. And that probably means rebuilding as it is.
While the engineers and government officials think the big thoughts and find the big money. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The geopolitical word of the day is decertify, to withdraw or revoke the certification of something. That's according to Webster's. The something here is the Iran nuclear deal, under which, by law, every 90 days, the president of the United States is required to certify that Iran is holding up its end of the bargain. And if not, well, then we'll see. Because so far, in the two or so years the deal has been in force, both Presidents Obama and Trump have certified Iran's compliance. Next week, though, President Trump is expected to, as I said, decertify. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains what's going on here and what it might mean for companies that have already started doing business in Iran.
So here's everyone who says Iran is holding up its end of the nuclear deal. The French, the British, the Germans, the international watchdog responsible for monitoring Iran, even members of the White House cabinet. Yet Trump wants to decertify the deal. Ambassador Dennis Ross has worked on Mideast policy under six U.S. presidents.
One of the things we've seen with this president is that he stakes out very tough public positions, but you don't always immediately see a follow-through.
Ross says decertifying the Iran deal fits the Trump pattern. Come out swinging to get a better stance in future negotiations. Also very Trump, punt the issue to Congress, says Mark Dubowitz of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
So after decertification, the Congress will then take up a debate and could reinstate the sanctions that were lifted under the nuclear deal.
Dubowitz says Congress will almost certainly not reinstate sanctions. The whole thing is a delicate political dance to signal to both Iran and our European allies that the U.S. wants a better deal. But Richard Nephew, who helped negotiate the Iran deal, says U.S. companies that have started doing business there need to take this seriously.
Yeah, because I don't think that we're going to just not impose sanctions and that's the end of it.
Instead, Nephew says, Trump's shift in posture towards Iran introduces even more uncertainty in the relationship, politically and economically. Any company betting on stable relations with Iran likely needs to reassess its odds. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Honestly, I feel the same way about making a movie as I feel about dating.
It's not you, it's me. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, pretty much flat, closed at 22,773. The NASDAQ barely changed. Another way to say pretty much flat, 6590 there. The S&P 500 down 2 points, about a 10%. 25 and 49 for the week. The 5 days gone by. The Dow up 1.6%. The Nasdaq up 1.4%. The S&P 500 added about 1.2%. Prices for crude oil are low-ish, and that has shares low too for the big players there. Chevron down 1.3%. Exxon took a 0.3% dive. Shell, the Dutch company, dipped 1.2% today. Lots of oil, by the way, down in the Gulf Coast region. Being shut in right now because of Hurricane Nate, tropical storm technically, Nate, that is on the way. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.36%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Amazon, as we all know, wants to take over basically the entire retail economy. I exaggerate, but not by too terribly much. One key part of that retail economy is how stuff gets to us. UPS and FedEx handle most of it for Amazon at the moment. But Bloomberg reports this week that Amazon is testing out a new service here on the West Coast, making deliveries for its third-party sellers. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains Amazon's logistics dilemma.
Amazon already warehouses products for some of its third-party sellers, so it's not a stretch to oversee shipping for them, too. It gives Amazon even more control over customer service and product flow without necessarily involving UPS or FedEx. Tom Forte at brokerage D.A. Davidson says it's also about getting shipping costs down.
FedEx and UPS are the Achilles heel of Amazon's business model. They essentially run a duopoly, and even in the depths of the recession, we're raising their rates.
The company has been growing its own small network of on-demand couriers delivering packages in their own cars. Research analyst Michael Pachter at Wedbush Securities says tapping into that network for third-party deliveries sends a message to the big parcel companies.
That, hey, we're going to build it out if you guys don't lower price.
How seriously should they take that threat? At the moment, FedEx and UPS have the upper hand. They're already delivering billions of packages a year for all sorts of companies. Amazon isn't.
Until they get critical mass where they're delivering in every neighborhood every single day, I just don't think it makes sense.
Amazon packages account for about 7% of UPS's volume and less than 3% for FedEx, says Satish Jindal at ShipMatrix. He says Amazon is growing fast, so even if it does more delivery itself, those carriers will be just fine.
They do not have to worry much. They will be getting a smaller piece of it, but that is still good growth from their point of view.
Amazon's pilot service will reportedly be rolled out across the country next year. I'm Aaron Schrenk for Marketplace.
Those of you listening closely to my interview with Outgoing Vanity Fair editor Graydon Carter last week might have heard us mention the magazine's new Establishment Summit, a conference celebrating entertainment's top 100 power players, as seen by the magazine, of course. The summit itself was this week out in Beverly Hills. I did a panel about the way the movie business seems to be splitting down the middle these days. Huge tent poles on one side, really low budget films on the other, and not a whole lot happening in the middle. On stage, it was me, Jason Blum. He's the founder of the low-budget production company Blumhouse. They did Whiplash, if you remember that one. Donna Langley, she is the chairwoman of Universal Pictures. And Patty Jenkins, maybe you saw a film she directed this summer, Wonder Woman. We're going to pick it up with Patty Jenkins and how she feels about the all-important Hollywood pitch meeting.
Honestly, I feel the same way about making a movie as I feel about dating. Like, I don't have any desire to sell or force. You know, like, I'm not trying to force anything. I feel like it's always like, is this a good fit? They should pitch to me, and that's fine. I think that's great. If they have something that they want to do, maybe I'll be the right match for it. Maybe I won't. And don't try to date somebody who's not right for you and then change who they are. I think it's important that I really hear them and they really hear me, and you're able to say, I think we could do something that we believe in together.
I would extend that.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
I would extend that to the pass. Which is all of us are out there trying to sell our movies and TV shows all the time. And we've all been doing this a long time. And the one thing I cannot tolerate, for exactly the reason that you said, is someone telling me why my TV show or movie is not good. It's not for you, of course. Yeah. This date is the wrong match. I get it. So I always say, please, if you're going to pass, keep it short and say it's not for me, just like a bad date.
Yeah.
We had the standard pre-conference call about a week or so ago, the four of us, to sort of get to know each other and figure out how we were going to go on this conversation. And I said, I think at the beginning when I joined the call, listen, I think it's really interesting, this conversation, because we've got the micro, we've got the blockbuster, and then we've got the person in the middle. And I said, Donna, and I really think there's still a place for you in this economic ecosystem. And you said you were surprised to hear me say that and relieved. And I want to know why you were surprised that people think there's still a place for studios in this content world that we have.
Because I think, well, you know, obviously, you know, with content being the proliferation of content and consumers, including myself, enjoying, you know, the ability to see content in a variety of different ways. Our job as people who are doing that for a studio and for the theatrical is to make films that are inherently theatrical. And so, yeah, we have to kind of wow them.
Studios are vital for filmmakers, for artists, because they make the world aware of what we've done. It's the marketing, right? Mm-hmm. And the positioning and the conversation around what we're doing. It's, you know, it's not as fun to make a movie if no one sees it. And I really think that on the movie business, the movie is 50% of the job and the marketing is the other 50% of the job. And if you don't get both those right, it's not nearly as fun.
Well, so granting that point, do you too, and let's pretend that the studio head's not sitting here, do you care how and where audiences and consumers get your content?
For sure.
You do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Explain.
I don't think that I have only one preference. I think it depends what the film is. But Wonder Woman, I definitely think we made it to play in a theater, you know? People will see it elsewhere, and that's what they'll do. But it's a big experience, and it's made to be a shared experience. You know, it's designed to be a shared experience. Other things I've made, I feel, are absolutely right to watch in more intimate space and at home or on a smaller screen. But I think it definitely matters.
Huh. Okay, so Donna, to that point of you being the facilitator in some ways of what these two do, you got your giant tent poles and you got your micro budgets. Giant tent poles, you can make $1 zillion. Micro budgets, you know, you may or may not, but it's going to cost you $1 million, whatever it is. Where's the space for the middle? For the filmmaker who wants to make I don't even know what a mid-market number is, $30 million? I mean, where is that space?
Yeah, in the $30, $40 million range.
I was close.
There is a market for it, absolutely. We've actually done very well with movies like, I think, Straight Out of Compton would fit right into that. Mamma Mia, probably Pitch Perfect now, where we are in that franchise. They're all considered mid-budget movies. And I think the common denominator between those films is that they're films that are made for a specific audience. They're delivering a specific experience, whether it be a musical or, in the case of Mamma Mia or 50 Shades of Grey, even, they were delivering to the female audience. And so I think where you can hit the sweet spot is where you can get something, you can deliver something for an audience, and particularly an underserved audience, and create some spectacle and some scope and deliver a really great, compelling reason to, you know, get out to the movie theater. Yeah. I think where we get into trouble is if it's a film that is trying to sort of serve too many masters and it maybe doesn't have a big enough idea to support the budget that it has. I mean, that can happen oftentimes. You know, the budget can rack up depending on who's in it and who's directing and things like that. So I think that's definitely the space to avoid. But, you know, I think that there is room for all different types of budget ranges within the studio system.
Since you brought up the idea of the female audience, Patty, and since, you know, you've got the movie with the female protagonist, the female director that's been remarkably successful, there's an obligation to ask you this question. Is it a good thing we're talking about female audiences and female protagonists in hit movies made by female directors, or would you rather we get to the point where you don't have to talk about it, you just get to make your damn movies?
I mean, definitely I'd rather we get there, but obviously we're not there, so it's a conversation that has to be had, and I'm honored to be a part of, you know? But what I'm always amazed by is, like, if it's understood that we can make a universal film about a turtle, like, why is it not understood that you could make a universal film about all kinds of people? And that it doesn't make it a turtle movie, and a woman doesn't make it a woman movie, you know, and all of this, universality is universality if we focus on it that way. And so that's what I want to make great films about, the life experience. And they maybe have female leads a lot, you know, but I don't want to make movies about being a woman necessarily. When I do that, maybe I will, maybe I won't, but it's not what it's about to me. It just happens to be a woman. And so, you know, Wonder Woman was about being a hero.
Jason, can you go to the movies now with an unjaundiced eye, or are you now?
I love going to the movies. I have a movie theater across the street from my house, and I go there at least twice a month. And I was talking in Las Vegas at a theater convention, and I told a story about my Regal and the great mozzarella cheese sticks there. Yeah. And now I have a free card to my movie theater. So I love going, and I love going to the cinema across the street from my house.
Patty, same question.
Well, I don't know, because I haven't gone to for the last 2.5 years, all I've done is make Wonder Woman, so no, I don't go to the movies at all.
Donna, what about you? Can you go to the movies just for the hell of it anymore?
I actually love just going and completely losing myself in a movie, someone else's movie, that I don't have to watch and think about all the pain and suffering there that took to get it to the screen.
Donna Langley, Universal, Patty Jenkins, filmmaker, and Jason Blum from Blum.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which innocence dies just a little bit more. You've heard of that big bull statue down by Wall Street, right? A pretty iconic piece of public sculpture at the heart of American market capitalism. And then the statue of the girl staring down that rampaging bull that was put up this past March by State Street Global Advisors, a $2-point-something trillion investment management company. Well, this week, State Street settled claims of gender pay discrimination made by more than 300 female executives. The women will split $5 million. If you've got daughters, though, that statue is pretty cool. All right, we are out of here on a Friday, flat and down just a tetch for Wall Street today. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Cesar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.